So the topic is basically the title is Complex Traits, What to Believe, which I think tries to get the gist of the one of the main messages here and fit into the number of characters I'm allotted for a title of a lecture. And it basically has to do with current efforts in human genetics to understand the role that inherited DNA sequence variation plays in regulating what are called complex traits. And let me just go through all that. So this is basically the plan for the talk, at least as it stands now, and just give you a little bit of introduction into complex traits and common disease and how they relate to each other. So here's a list of, a somewhat random list of diseases that you might see in a hospital or in a doctor's office, and account for, you know, a lot of morbidity and mortality. And it turns out that most of these diseases cluster in families in ways that tell us that genetics plays a role in regulating who will and will not come down with these diseases. Same thing is true for things that aren't diseases but are quantitative traits that you can measure. Some of these, however, are very significant risk factors. I list here just things that are relevant to endocrinology, which is one of my interests. But, you know, things like blood pressure, obviously, if you have high blood pressure, that's a huge risk factor for heart disease, stroke, et cetera, et cetera. Increased obesity is a huge risk factor for death and diabetes and heart disease, and many of these other things also have to do with future diseases. And these also cluster in families in ways that tell us that genetics plays a role. But for all of these, whether it's disease susceptibility or the quantitative trait illustrated here, adult height, we know also from the way that they cluster in families that multiple genes are involved, and furthermore that environmental and other non-genetic influences must play a role as well. So this is not quite so simple a picture as, for example, trying to track down the gene that's responsible for cystic fibrosis or for Tay-Sachs disease. And so the goal that a lot of people in genetics have is to try to make this connection. There's variation in the human genome, which I'll talk quite extensively about, and there's variation that we observe out in the world, and we know there's a connection here, and it's a question of making that connection. And if you compare genomes, as again as I'll get to in a little bit, you find that people are mostly the same, but there are differences between every person. And again, most of these differences are random spelling differences in the genetic code that have no consequence, but some of them do have biological consequence. And again, the challenge is to figure out which one of these differences matter. So I said that we know that genetics plays a role, and I just want to briefly get into how do we know that, actually. So one way is from something called twin studies. I forgot the little English. This is from some country music group that I have no affiliation with and have never heard, called the Taylor Brothers, but notable for the part of their promotions that they're identical twins, and you know, you can see things like they're, you know, they look the same, they're about the same height. I'm not sure whether you can tell whether they have the same preference in clothing or not from this, but you know, they may have some of the same aptitudes. So, and what you can do is you can do twin studies where you compare identical twins to twins who are what are called dizygotic twins, or basically what are also commonly called fraternal twins. If you compare same-sex fraternal twins and identical twins, they're in theory raised in about the same amount of shared environment, so they're both raised in the same household and that sort of thing. But identical twins or monozygotic twins share 100% of their DNA, whereas dizygotic twins share only 50% of their DNA. They share the same as siblings. And so if there are things that are more concordant or more similar in monozygotic twins than in dizygotic twins, the usual conclusion is that genetics plays a role in that similarity. So for example, if you look at type 2 diabetes, if you look at monozygotic twins and follow them over their lifetime, there's at least an 80%, and some people think it's actually close to 100% concordance rate. What that means is actually sort of striking, which means that if that there is a particular set of genotypes which is incredibly predictive of getting diabetes. Yes, thank you. Sorry, I found a little cable. So one right one and one wrong one. So I'm all right. Whereas if you look at dizygotic twins, there's a lot of concordance, and part of that is because they share 50% of their genetic material, and part of it's probably because they share the environment that they shared. But the concordance rate is much, much higher for monozygotic twins, so that says that there's a strong genetic influence. And you can do other studies that don't depend on twin studies, and you can also do twin studies where there are monozygotic twins reared apart, but those are much less common. but basically family studies where you look at if somebody has diabetes, what's the risk to their sibling for getting diabetes as opposed to the risk of somebody next door, for example. And again, it's much greater for siblings than it is for the general population. That's something, that ratio is something called lambda S. And you can estimate also something called heritability, which is purports to be the percentage of variation that's attributable to genetic factors and actually certain types of genetic factors. Okay, so that's basically an introduction. So these, their most common diseases are these complex genetic traits where we know genes play a role, and we also know from those family studies they don't just segregate in a simple pattern where, you know, if the father has it, half of the children will have it, and the half of their children will have it, etc., and or in a simple recessive pattern, but it's clearly multifactorial. So the next section is basically why we think that there might be a connection between common genetic variation and these common diseases. So this is a stretch of a genome. I think I borrowed this from David Altshuler or Eric Lander, I'm not sure. And this is what genetic variation looks like, okay? So you have a long stretch here, and if you compare two stretches taken from different people, you'll find that there's one place here and one place here where maybe they differ, okay? And most of those variants change a single nucleotide or single DNA letter, and it's called, therefore, single nucleotide polymorphism. It means many forms, or in this case, it would be just two forms, or a SNP for short. And what you might find is there's a stretch of DNA where everybody's the same, and then at this nucleotide, some people have a C and some people have a T. And what we want to know is, of all these different genetic variants, which ones are going to be the ones that are going to affect things that we care about? So, you know, here's something that we should all be passionate about in the next few months. So, you know, whether you're, you know, happy or sad that A-Rod went to the Yankees or something like that. But no, in seriousness, you know, if this were, you know, healthy and disease, not to say which is which here, then we would be interested to see which variants track along with disease, and that's going to be the general gist of what people are trying to do. So I said that there's a connection between common variants and disease, and so one question is why might we be interested in common variants? And if you think about it, before we begin, what's known so far about genetic disease, you might say, well, that's kind of the wrong place to look, because if you look at things like Tay-Sachs or cystic fibrosis, those are mostly caused by genetic variants. They're quite rare in the population. They're severe, deleterious mutations that cause these severe diseases. So if those genetic diseases are caused by rare variants, why wouldn't things like diabetes be caused by rare variants? And it's an open question, I'll get into that, but let me just take you through at least some of the background. So I showed you earlier that if you sequence a stretch of genome, imagine this is about 1,000 bases from two different chromosomes. It could be two chromosomes from the same person, or it could be one chromosome from somebody here and one chromosome from somebody around the world. You'd get the same answer, more or less, which is that on average you'd see about one every 1,200 bases would be different. You can then ask the question, well, having identified these two alleles, the C allele and the A allele, if I then look in the same 1,000 bases at lots of other chromosomes, is it that this A allele or maybe this C allele is just a really unique event that's private to one of these chromosomes, or do I see both alleles around the whole world? And the answer, most of the time, about 90% of the time, is that you see both alleles around the world. And so what that means is that most of the differences that you can find between two chromosomes are explainable or attributable to the variation, those variants that are common, that are shared throughout the world, that are not like the Tay-Sachs mutations, but they're actually old variants that happened a long time ago and are present in multiple populations around the world. So, right, and that's basically what that says. And so this has led to a hypothesis. So the assumptions are as follows. First of all, that most variation in the genome is evolutionarily neutral. That actually may or may not be true, but as long as it's not most variation is evolutionarily beneficial, we're okay. But let's assume there's some background for the genome, so that, you know, you have a SNP that's, you know, 22 kb away from the nearest gene and probably doesn't affect the function of that gene at all. Let's assume that evolution has not particularly cared about that base change. We know that most of this variation, most of the background variation, is probably what I should call this rather than neutral, is due to these common variants. That's what I just showed you, that 90% of that variation is due to the common variants. We know also what I've been telling you with the Tay-Sachs disease, that traits under negative selection will in fact be largely due to rare variants, and there's a nice description of why this should be true in an article by Jonathan Pritchard. But there's a hypothesis that traits that are not under negative selection, or at least not under severe negative selection, will actually be due to variants that look more like the background, so that are common variants. And so this is what's called the common disease, common variant hypothesis. And one of the more forceful, I would say, descriptions of it is a paper by Reich and Lander, Trends in Genetics, 2002. And the idea for why common diseases might be due to alleles that are not under severe negative selection goes like this. First of all, they're actually common, so in some sense it sounds tautological, but it's actually not. They can't be that evolutionarily deleterious if they're extremely common. So that's one argument. Two is that they're multifactorial, so each gene that contributes to these common diseases actually only contributes a little bit to susceptibility, and that's going to be a theme that'll run through this whole talk. So even if they were somewhat evolutionarily deleterious, each individual allele would only be contributing a small fraction of that. Third is they often tend to be late onset or so after reproductive age. So again, evolution cares less about stuff like that. Although we don't know, maybe good to have had your grandfather around in Africa 50,000 years ago. So it could be the late onset diseases were bad. Another thing is that it's been hypothesized that some of these diseases like hypertension or diabetes actually have what's called balancing selection, which is that they give you diabetes late in life, but the reason that they give you diabetes is because they help make you hold on to calories better. So that gives you obesity now when we have McDonald's around, but 100,000 years ago when food was scarce, maybe that was really good. That's something called the thrifty gene hypothesis. Similarly for hypertension, maybe it was good to hold on to salt if you lived in a desert, that sort of thing. So if we're looking for common variation, or thinking about that, this may be a good place to look for the genetic variants that underlie common disease. And again, this hypothesis does not say that rare variation won't also contribute to common disease. It just says that common variation will be part of the contributors. So if we're looking for it, it's been estimated that there are about 10 million common SNPs where both alleles are found at more than 1% in the general population. About 6 million of those are actually already in databases. So it's actually a good fraction have been found. And as you'll see, there's a lot of redundancy between SNPs. So probably a very high fraction of the variation, common variation in the genome, actually has been cataloged, which is a remarkable thing. When I started in this field in not very long ago, I think 6 years ago, there was a paper that came out of the Lander Lab, which is a massive tour de force, cataloging 2,000 SNPs across the genome. And this quintupled the number of SNPs that were known. Okay, and so this is now 3,000 times as many now, and just in the last 6 years. And you can find all of these in websites like dbSNP or the UCSC genome browser, and NCBI has a genome browser, and they're all right there. So this is a screenshot from the UCSC genome browser. Each one of these little lines is a SNP, and this is probably already out of date, even though I took it not too long ago from there. And this is just in one gene, each of these are on each of these two columns is a SNP. Okay, so if we want to use this catalog of common variation to try to find the alleles that are responsible for disease, how can we do that? Well, one way would actually be to try to study every variant, or at least every common variant. This would be great. It would be an unbiased search of the entire genome, basically the entire universe of common variation. And this would be great if we could do it, but it's not currently practical. 10 million variants. And as I'll show you, you need many thousands of people to do this, so it actually works out to hundreds of billions of genotypes. So that's something like the Pentagon budget or something for a year to do one study. So NIH doesn't like grants like that. So basically, until this gets much cheaper and or we apply some of the shortcuts that I'll tell you about, you need to pick which genes and variants we're going to study. All right, so this brings into methods for finding traits. Any questions so far? Okay, so we're on the track of trying to find which of these common variants might be contributing to common diseases. So really kind of three approaches, two of which have to do with common variants, and one actually which explicitly has to do with rare variants, and I'll get to that at the end. So the traditional approach to finding genes for disease has actually been something called linkage. I don't know, have you guys done linkage? Is that something that's been done here? Yes, no? So I'll briefly go through linkage. So linkage requires families where you have, in the case of disease, multiple affected relatives in the same family. Okay, so those could be brother, sister, or it could be cousins, or you know, an uncle and a niece or something like that. And the idea is that there is a single disease-causing allele that's segregating in that family, so it's being passed on to some of the people in the family and not others. And the other assumption is that the disease will more or less, doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be pretty good, will more or less track with that allele. Now for linkage, you're not actually typing the allele itself. What you're doing, you're typing markers that surround the allele. So they may be a couple of million bases away, actually. And that's sort of a typical thing is about markers spaced every 10 million, every sort of few to 10 million bases. And the idea is that since you're just looking in a family, it turns out that a million bases is what's called one centimorgan, which means that recombination events happens once every 100 meiosis. Okay, so within a few centimorgans, there's generally not going to be any recombination events within a family. So the marker that's a few million bases away will travel with the disease allele in the family. So you use that marker as a surrogate for the disease allele, and you follow the marker through the family, and you say which of these markers. So if this marker is traveling with disease, you say maybe that's pretty close to the disease allele, but a marker on some other chromosome won't be segregating with the disease, so you'll say that region isn't linked. So that's linkage, basically. So traditionally it's been microsatellites, which are markers that are things like repeats of the sequence TA, 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 and some people have, DNA polymerase doesn't like to copy those very well, so some people have 50 copies, some people have 44, some people have 53, that sort of thing. And you can type those. Those are a pain in the ass to work with, actually. And so people are shifting over, starting to use SNP-based linkage analysis, because all you need is basically a marker that lets you distinguish each of the chromosomes that are segregating in the family. So probably microsatellites there's going to be a shift. But this has been wildly successful for single gene disorders. And the reason it's been successful is because there's always just a single copy in a family of the disease allele, and the segregation with disease and that marker is really very good, because if you have the disease-causing allele, you get disease, and if you don't, you don't. So for common diseases, none of those things are true. First of all, because multiple genes are involved, you might not have the disease-causing allele, but get the disease anyway, and vice versa. You might have the disease susceptibility allele, really, it should be called, and not get the disease. And furthermore, there might be multiple, because it might be a common variant, there actually might be multiple copies of the susceptibility allele traveling in the same family. So the markers that are a couple million bases away now no longer perfectly mark the disease susceptibility allele, because maybe on this side of the family it's marked by, you know, it travels with this marker, this allele, but then on this side of the family where it's segregating, it travels with a different marker. So all of these things conspire against you for common diseases. Nonetheless, people have found a couple of things through linkage of common diseases and tracked it down. Decode genetics in Iceland is probably the most prolific example of that. So if linkage isn't working, it brings us to the other main approach that's used, which I'll spend a lot of the talking about, because it is the main method. It's called association studies. And basically what this means is that rather than searching through the whole genome, you pick candidate genes. And this is, Rish and Marikangas have shown that this is much better suited than linkage to things where this scenario where you have common alleles that have only modest effects on disease, what's called modest penetrance. And then there's another approach that people are taking, which is they say, okay, I understand linkage might not be the best way to go, but I don't believe this common variant stuff. I want to look for rare variants that contribute to disease. And so there what you are doing is, again, you're picking the genes to look at, but instead of just taking SNPs off the public map and looking for common variation, they're actually resequencing to try to find those rare variants that are present only in disease. And the best examples of this are BRCA1 for breast cancer, which is actually originally identified by linkage, but that's sort of a rare disease. And also MC4R mutations, there's a melanocortin 4 receptor gene where there's a lot of rare variants that contribute to early onset, particularly severe obesity. The difficulty with this approach right now is it's very expensive. It's much more expensive to resequence than it is to do genotyping of polymorphisms. And if the expense were flipped, people would probably do this resequencing because this gets you the common variants as well. And it's really just, it's largely an expense issue that we can't do this. So, you know, I talked about the study that would take, you know, just the Pentagon budget. If you were going to do this, this would take, you know, probably the GDP for the history of the United States or something like that. So we're still a ways away from this.
Yeah. That sort of flies in the face of the whole hypothesis that
these things are constructed. Yes, so I'm just saying that if you choose to, I don't mean to say that the hypothesis has been proven. I believe that common variants contribute to common disease. There are still people who believe that that's not true at all, and that really this is the only thing that's ever going to yield anything, is looking for rare variants. So, and there are definitely, you know, a couple of cases where this has been true, and this really hasn't been explored to any degree just because it's so expensive. And I put it there just because if all of a sudden to sequence somebody's genome for $100 became feasible, you would take 1,000 people with diabetes and sequence their genomes, and that would be the way you do the experiment. So that's why it's on there. Okay, so this is sort of a cartoon version of what I just told you. Linkage analysis lets you search the whole genome and points you to a region, although it does not point you to the gene. So remember, those markers are 10 million bases apart. And in fact, because of some of the vagaries of complex trait genetics and the reasons that linkage isn't that well suited, usually you get about a 20 centimorgan region, or about 20 million bases, which can have something like 200 genes in it. And it'll say somewhere in those 200 genes, there's something that's contributing to disease. Whereas association, you're looking one gene at a time, so you're not, but you have to guess correctly where to go. And so, you know, you have to, so there's this haystack here of 30,000 genes or 30,000 straws, and you can pull one out and say, you know, is that a straw or a needle? No, it's a straw, next one, and look. And obviously the success depends on you being able to guess correctly. But we actually, at least for the first time, we know what the 30,000 straws are, right? So that, you know, there's a website now with the entire genome on it. And we're getting pretty good, as I'll tell you, at telling whether things are real contributors to disease or not. But it's this interpretation of whether this is a straw or a needle that is going to be the focus of a lot of the talk, because that's the study that a lot of people do, is they pick a gene and they test it and they claim it either does or does not have a role in disease. And I sort of want to give you some, hopefully some sophistication in reading those sorts of studies to try to say, should you believe everything that you read? Which the obvious answer is no, but. So this is what an association study is. You can imagine that you had healthy individuals and people with Alzheimer's disease, and there's a common variant in the APOE gene called APOE4, it encodes apolipoprotein E, and it is a common variant because if you look in the control population, you'll see it's there about 10% of the time, something like that. But if you look in people with Alzheimer's disease, you'll see that its frequency is increased about threefold. And so this is the paradigm for associations of common disease and common variants. And this has been seen over and over again. You look in just about every study that's been done, you see this increase in risk. Yeah.
Sorry.
No, sure.
You also look, obviously, you look across
ethnicity. Yeah, so actually, yeah, so there's a little bit of a subtlety to even this association. So it has been seen in other ethnicities. It looks, although the last time I looked at this, the data were not strong enough to say that there was definitely a difference, but it looks like the association with Alzheimer's disease might be a little bit weaker in African-derived populations. There could be a wide variety of reasons why that's true, and I'll go through a bunch of them. Just in general.
No,
you would. So the rate, the frequency of APOE4 in this case doesn't actually vary that much across populations. It's an old allele. Some alleles do, and you're getting into something called ethnic admixture, which I'll definitely get to in a little bit. Okay, so as I said, you have to guess right. So there's an issue of which genes do you guess, and ideally, again, one would like to do all of them. And it's getting closer to be able to do that, but yeah.
Individuals with the UCRA1 example, but when you take the leakage study and find that region that seems to be linked?
So that's definitely one thing you would do. So it's actually been hard enough until basically this year to do that. So, you know, you have 200 genes, and to thoroughly go through a gene and basically look at all 200 of them has been something that's just basically been out of reach. So to give you an example, I just got, I think, funded to do exactly that for an obesity linkage peak, and we couldn't have really written to do that. It's sort of a part of a regular R01 type grant. We could not have written an R01 to do that a year ago. It was just too expensive and too hard. Just the information about which variants to type, and I'll go through again using haplotypes and stuff like that to do it. The information just wasn't there, and the expense was too high. But yes, I agree, those would be the first candidates. So this is, you know, you would use information from linkage studies, and you might just say, you know, I don't care about anything else that anybody says. I'm going to take linkage. You know, if your complex trait or your common disease is fortunate enough to have a linkage peak that you believe, which is not true for most of them, actually, but some of them it is, you would say, okay, those are the 200 best genes. I'm going to go for those. That's definitely an approach. You might say, well, you know, linkage is not very well powered for common disease. Probably most of the genes are not under linkage peaks, and most of the genes under the linkage peak are not the right one. So I'm going to ignore that. I'm going to go for things that, you know, I'm going to say 100 years of research has meant something, and if I'm studying diabetes, I'm going to do the insulin signaling pathway and beta cell function and, you know, fat cell differentiation genes and stuff like that, and those are the genes I'm going to go for. Or you might say, well, you know, this is just, you know, lamppost science because it's the biology that people have been doing, and this is not very powered, but this is a genome-wide tool. We can use expression analysis. So survey all the genes, find things that are expressed at different levels in disease versus healthy people, and say that, you know, some of those, many of those changes might be secondary to the disease state. Maybe some of those represent a primary regulatory variant that affects disease, and so I'm going to look for those. And, you know, what we're trying to do, and other people are trying to do, is actually the most interesting genes are probably the ones that happen to fall in here, although there's no saying that, you know, that they have to fall into this intersection. Maybe they fall in here or there or there, even just one of these, or, you know, in the universe outside altogether. But I'll just give you an example for type 2 diabetes, just because we are actually doing this sort of thing. So there is hundreds of years of biology, or 100 years of biology probably, on diabetes. A lot of mouse models, single gene disorders that cause the disease. So that's another sort of thing. If severe variation causes a severe form of the disease, maybe mild variation causes a late onset form. So there's a list of genes there. So for diabetes, this is one of those things where there really isn't a perfect linkage peak to go under. There's Graham Bell's group identified the calpain 10 gene by going under a peak where they had significant linkage, although if you actually put all the linkage evidence together from everybody, you would not have said that there was any significant linkage to diabetes there. That association is probably true, not, you know, so that you can do this, but it's not the end all. And then there's been expression studies in diabetes that's pointed to a pathway of oxidative phosphorylation. Some colleagues of mine, Vamsi Mutha, David Altshuler, Lake Group, Cecilia Lindgren and others, and also a paper from the Joslin, Mary Elizabeth Patty's pointed to that pathway. And there are genes that are actually in this, you know, red area, a few of them. So, you know, we're going after those genes, for example. So that's kind of picking genes, and it's sort of more of a, at this point, more of kind of a, you know, art form than, you know, any computerized algorithm to do it, although just even getting all that information into one place where you could even do the queries of what genes are under linkage peak, what genes are differentially expressed, what genes are in known pathways, that's actually tools that we're sort of just trying to develop. So, okay, so which genes and then which variants? So ideally, you have the disease-causing allele in your hand and you're genotyping it and you test it, because there the marker that you're testing, as opposed to being, you know, distance away, is perfectly correlated with the variants. That's the ideal situation. And so that implies that maybe we should actually really concentrate our efforts on finding the variants that are most likely to be functional. So similar to the way you might try to find the genes that are most likely to be responsible. So the most obvious things are missense variants. And these are easy to recognize. It's been shown, if you look at they're much rarer than they should be, which means evolution has cared about them to suppress them. So many of them are actually mildly deleterious, which maybe, you know, they're not severe deleterious, but maybe there's just the right balance of things to cause common disease. And even if you're doing rare variants, you can recognize them and group them together and study them as a class if you want to say, if you have the model that rare variants cause disease. So, but we know, and there are plenty of cases now where the variant that's been finally identified is actually, for a complex trait, has not been a missense variant, but has been a regulatory variant that affects the level of the gene, but not the structure of the protein it encodes. There's a great example from type 1 diabetes, from John Todd's group and others, where there was a missense variant that was thought to be the right variant, but then they did a huge study and showed that, in fact, all of the association that they saw with the missense variant was actually explained by something in the 3' UTR and affected the level of the gene. So the question is, well, these are hard to recognize. There's lots of variation out there. We have no idea how to read. So the reason we can recognize missense variants, right, is we know the genetic code, right? They cracked that, you know, soon after DNA. But we don't know the regulatory code. So there's some effort now to try to crack, essentially, the regulatory code by using multiple species and doing comparisons. So this is from Eddie Rubin's group. This is a great website. It's called the ECR browser. And you can see what you see here is regions that are actually evolutionarily conserved across species and therefore may be important. Evolution has cared about them again. So they may be important regulatory regions. And there's experimental backup for that hypothesis. So basically, that would suggest that we should, and Rish and Botstein have suggested this approach, at least for missense variants, that we should resequence targeted regions, try to find every variant that's in there, and make sure we type all of them. And again, the issue is that resequencing is expensive. But we might not have the causal variant in hand if we don't go through this approach, or if we're bad at guessing what the regulatory variants are. So we should try to understand also the correlation between variants. I alluded to the fact that SNPs are redundant with each other. So if you have the causal variant that hasn't been genotyped, you have to infer its effect by genotyping neighboring SNPs. And so they have to be correlated, or what's called in linkage disequilibrium, with the causal variant. It turns out that a lot of the times that's true. So this is actually what the genome looks like most of the time, or most of the genome, where this is that slide that I showed you before. Imagine this is now zoomed out. We're looking at 30,000 bases of a bunch of different chromosomes. What you see is if you have a C here and a C here, you can predict that you're going to have a G here, a C here, an A here, and a C there. And these patterns of alleles are called haplotypes. And in most of the genome, there are these blocks of correlation or blocks of linkage disequilibrium where there are only a few common haplotypes. In this case, there's the red, the blue, and the yellow. And occasionally, there's shuffling by recombination. These were first identified by Mark Daly and colleagues in Nature Genetics, and then this sort of shown to be true on a genome-wide scale is Stacey Gabriel et al. And the reason this is useful is that if there's a causal polymorphism, but not one that you've typed, you can predict it pretty well by the neighboring markers, that if you have a C here and an A here, then you probably are carrying this causal polymorphism. I'll take you through briefly, but I'm going to blow through this a little bit, just the range of what these patterns look like. There's a measure of correlation, which is not important to understand, called D prime. Basically, red means that the SNPs are correlated with each other, and any other color means that you're not sure if they are. And I'll show you a little plot like this, where this is the data for markers 1 and 2, and this is the data for markers 3 and 5. And this is what blocks look like, where you see a whole bunch of red triangle here, which means that all the markers 1 to 6 are correlated with each other, and then here 8 to 13 are all correlated with each other, and that corresponds to there being two blocks of linkage disequilibrium. And if you, again, from the Gabriel et al. Paper, if you look, just concentrate on the figure on the right, in, for example, a European population or Asian population, over almost 40% of the genome is found in blocks of over 50 kb, and the average block size is about 22 kb. So on average, if you look in the genome, there's this correlation that extends for tens of thousands of bases, sort of on the order of the size of a gene, although it doesn't necessarily correlate perfectly with genes. And within those blocks, as I showed you with that red, blue, and yellow pattern, there's only a few common haplotypes present, so, you know, sort of in the order of 3 to 4 for non-African populations and 1 or 2 more for African populations, and they explain the vast majority of the chromosomes in that population. And furthermore, the haplotypes themselves are generally shared. Again, Africans have a little bit more, and this is because when humans emerged from Africa, only a subset of the genetic diversity went with them, so Africa is actually a more diverse continent than the rest of the world is. And I won't go through the reasons that blocks exist, but basically it has to do with sort of the nature of recombination, the fact that they're hotspots of recombination, and this emergence, this out of Africa pattern. And so that's led to a proposal that basically, if you can recognize these red, blue, and yellow patterns, you can then identify a few tag SNPs, in this case two, which distinguish those patterns. So if you have the red variant, if you have the variant for tag SNP 1, you're red. If you have the variant for tag SNP 2, you're yellow. And if you don't have either variant, you must have been blue. And so this means that if you can type enough markers to distinguish these patterns, you can then identify these tag SNPs. And that greatly reduces the effort you need to cover a region. And so that's the goal of the human haplotype map, which is ongoing as a $100 million international project. It's basically to type about a million or more markers in three different reference populations, European American, West African, and then East Asian, which is Japanese and Chinese. And you can go to the HapMap website or see this Nature description. But its goal is to identify all these tag SNPs. And so the approach would basically take the SNPs from the database, genotype these SNPs in reference panels, measure the linkage to seek equilibrium, and then identify the tag SNPs, and then select them, and then take those SNPs and type them in population. Okay. So that's kind of how one would set up in 2004 to do an association study, where you pick genes, you would understand the haplotype structure, you might even do some resequencing to make sure you had all the missense variants, and then you would take some subset of variants and type them in populations, do your association study. The problem is that after you've done all that work to set up to do this, you do an association, you publish it, and you find that it's very difficult for anybody else to reproduce it. Okay, so that was a lot of work for nothing, right? So we wanted to understand, if we were going to try to use this as a tool, well, why are association studies not reproduced? And there's really three possible explanations. One is, could be false positives. So when you did your association, it was just wrong. Okay, you know, maybe you've tested a lot of genes and tested a lot of variants in a lot of genes, and by chance you got a p-value of 0.01. okay, so you go ahead and you publish it, and it was just because you'd flipped a coin a bunch of times and you got a run of heads. Okay, it doesn't mean the coin is two-headed. It could mean that in fact you were right, but then the people who came after you had little small studies, and they were looking for a modest effect, and they just didn't have enough power. Okay, so it actually was, the coin was unfair, right? So it does come up heads more often than tails, but they only flipped it five times and it came up tails, you know, or they only flipped it six times and it came up heads three times and tails three times. This is equivalent to doing a study with not very many people. Okay, so that's a sort of lack of power. And then there could be true differences between populations, so that the marker really is associated with disease in your population, but not in the population that somebody else studied. So we set out to kind of overview the association study literature and say, well, what explanations are actually going on here? And we identified, as of 2000 or 2001, just over 600 associations between common variants and disease, and there are way more than this now. There were 166 that had been studied at least three times, so we get to get a handle on their reproducibility. And the first thing we noticed was of those 166, only six were actually highly consistently reproducible. So only six were seen three quarters of the time. So you could say, well, this is just terrible. Okay, almost all associations just are not really reproducible. Or you could say, well, you know, actually, you've only tested 166 things. You found six real ones. That's pretty good. You know, there are 10 million things to test out there. Okay, so these are the six, and one of them is this paradigm that I showed you, APOE4. Then there's things like CCR5, Delta32, this CTLA4. Interesting, this is that missense variant that I told you about that actually now this should be corrected to the 3' UTR. So even though they didn't have the right variant, it was still pretty reproducible. Factor V and deep venous thrombosis and a couple of others. And there are more on this list now, although not many, that are that highly consistently reproducible. So what about the other 160? Are they just complete nonsense? Or what? Why are they not reproducible? Well, the next thing we noticed was that of the 160, 91 of them were actually seen multiple times. So not just by the person who reported them, but by somebody else as well. And so that suggested that maybe there was something real going on, but we wanted to look at that in sort of a more formal way. And so to do that, we basically picked 25 of these 160 associations for some diseases we cared about and some others at random. And we got rid of the first person who reported it. And we said, of all the other people who tried to replicate it, how well did they do? So there were 301 studies for these 25 associations. And if all of those 25 associations were incorrect, we would expect that the follow-up studies, in theory or naively, should have 5% of them should have, again, been statistically significant with a p-value of 0.05, 1% should have had a p-value of 0.01, et cetera, et cetera. So what did we see? We actually found that about a fifth of them had p-values of less than 0.05. So this is way, way more than you would expect. This is not just by chance. And encouragingly, most of the associations were in the same direction, so it was the same allele that was associated with disease as was in the original report. Okay, so it's actually, that would only happen not 1 in 20 times, but 1 in 40 times. And furthermore, it wasn't that each of the 25 had a few replications. It was that there was a subfraction of them that had a lot of replications, and then the rest of them were never seen again. Okay. So you might say, could this be publication bias? So we obviously could only look at the reports that were published. So it might be that there were lots of people doing these studies out there, and when they got a p-value of less than 0.05, they broke out the champagne, celebrated, and sent the report off to the journal. But maybe if they did it and the p-value wasn't over 0.05, it lingered in the desk drawer, and that's actually the formal name for this thing, is the desk drawer phenomenon. And so what we asked was, could there be a universe of unpublished studies lingering in desk drawers around the world that would explain why we saw so many of these studies? How many unpublished studies would we have to hypothesize per association to explain the fraction we saw? Was it 1 or 2 or 3? Or was it just, you know, a ludicrous number of studies out there? And it turned out, actually, you would have to postulate a ludicrous number of studies to explain the positives we saw. You would have to postulate about 40 to 80 unpublished negative studies lingering in desk drawers around the world. And there just aren't even that many people doing association studies for any of these diseases. So we think this is, and we did some other work to show this is not publication bias. Okay, so you'd asked about ethnic admixture stratification, so I want to talk about that for a little bit.
I have one question.
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead. Yep.
All the diseases made sense, but of course, probably not. That's only because it's a rare disease.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's not a common disease. You're right. So it's a very environmental disease, right? So what it is actually, it's probably a common disease, but just the environmental exposure that's required is rare. So it's sort of like, and you actually, another one was HIV, which unfortunately is not a rare disease now because the environmental exposure is so common. But you could imagine if the world were a different place, would be a rare disease, and the same sort of thing. And it may be the same thing as diabetes, where, you know, type 2 diabetes may be a common disease in part because the environmental exposure is.
I'm not sure how they can.
So it turns out that it's actually a huge risk factor. It's a huge genetic risk factor. There's an interesting article in Science looking at this variant, showing that there's been waves of selection in favor of the resistance variant in tribes that where prion diseases are endemic.
It's pretty
common. Yeah, it's pretty common, and it turns out that it's a big effect. So that's how you get power. So that even it, you know, and there are enough sporadic, you know, there's sort of people collect like a couple hundred sporadic cases here and there, and it's just a big effect, and that's why they were able to see it. So even rare diseases can have common variants that contribute to them. Okay, so ethnic admixture, what is that? So this is sort of an ideal epidemiology study. So when people collect cases and controls, they often will ask about ethnicity. They have what's called self-described ethnicity. And the ideal thing is that you would, you know, clearly everybody matches on what people put down, but people will self-describe differently, and there may not be an accurate self-description for what people's actual ethnic and, you know, genetic backgrounds are. So you hope that somehow, just, you know, that this self-described ethnicity is good enough, that you actually have a good match. But you can imagine that within some ethnic group, there might be a couple of subgroups, and this is obviously the distinctions are, I've drawn this as, you know, there's, you know, the blue subgroup and the green subgroup, but in reality it would probably be some, you know, shading from blue to blue-green to green-blue to, you know, green. So you can imagine that there might be some different ethnic subgroups, and you could think about this, for example, European might be Northern European and Southern European or something like that. And there might be diseases where the disease actually is more prevalent, let's say, in Northern Europe. So you might have more cases from the Northern European ancestry and more controls from the Southern European ancestry, and that's, for example, type 1 diabetes might fit this pattern. Much more common in Finland than in south of France, for example. So if you then had a marker that was tracked genetically with Northern European ancestry, but not with Southern European ancestry, and there are not a lot of markers like that, but there are at least one that I know of, then you might find that that marker would be overrepresented in the cases relative to the controls, just because that ethnic group was overrepresented. And this is thought to be more of a problem also in populations that have had recent admixture, like African American populations or Latino populations, where instead of this being Northern European, Southern European, this might be degree of ancestry, so what fraction of your chromosomes have alleles that are more common in Europe versus alleles that are more common in Africa. And you can end up with this same setup. So you can get, in theory, false positive associations from that. So there are ways around it now. So the first way that was proposed by Rich Spielman and then a whole bunch of other people is to use what are called family-based tests of association. And I'm not going to go through the details of those other than to tell you that they are immune to this problem. And the other way is to basically, if you can't do the family-based test, and there are a lot of reasons you might not be able to, you can use something called genomic control, where you type a lot of random markers and you see, well, do those random markers give you these spurious associations? And you can use those to correct your association results or even to rematch your cases and controls to make sure that they're genetic, regardless of what the self-described ethnicity is, you can match them sort of by their genetic background as assessed by these 100 markers. So we actually looked, at least for our little study, most of the things that it replicated are actually seen in family-based studies or in multiple ethnic groups, which makes admixture less likely. But it doesn't mean that this isn't going on in a rampant way. And like, you know, for example, the ones that were never replicated could well be that some of those false positives are due to admixture. Then there's sort of a true population differences that could be coming into play. There's a lot of different things. It could be, you know, different diets in different populations. It could be that there are other genes that are more common in one population than in another, and there's some interaction between what you're looking at and that. And I want to talk about one very specific type of difference that at least we could address, which is that there might be different patterns of correlation in different populations, and the marker that's being used might not be the causal marker. It might be something which is correlated. So I showed you this diagram where you could use this CA haplotype. You know, if you look at this two-marker haplotype, use this CA haplotype to try to predict whether the causal polymorphism is there. And it does pretty well because there wasn't very much of this recombinant haplotype here. So here, actually, the prediction, I haven't drawn the arrows, but the prediction would actually not be right for this one chromosome. But most of the time, the correlation is pretty good. But what if there was a lot of that recombinant chromosome in some other population? Now, all of a sudden, you have this a common CA haplotype without the causal SNP. And so, in addition to, you know, being the correlation is now no longer so good, so you might not see an association. So that's at least one possible thing to keep in mind, is that the marker that you're looking at might not be the causal thing. So basically, understanding the LD patterns around an association. So once an association has been found, typing lots of other markers in there and seeing, is there another marker that explains it better, will become important, and almost nobody does that right now. And then finally, the last thing that we looked at was, could it be that some of the associations that we were seeing in our meta-analysis were actually true, but the studies that said that there was no association were actually incorrect? And so to try to get a sense for this, what that requires is that the sample sizes were too small to detect the association, which means in turn that the association must have been a weak association, or a modest effect. So we estimated the effects for all of these associations and by pooling all of the data. And so 8 of them replicated. And the question was, what was the effect sizes? And basically, all 8 increased the risk of disease by less than 2-fold. And some of them was like just a 10% increased risk of disease associated with having the allele. And for 10%, for example, you need thousands of cases and controls. And almost none of the studies we looked at had that. So almost all the studies were underpowered for almost all of the associations we looked at. So lack of power is rampant in this field. And a negative study by itself unless it's got many thousands of people, really can't be taken to be worth much, other than by itself. It can be worth a lot in context of other studies. One last thing that I want to just take you through again, because it's an important issue thinking about interpreting the literature. When we did this estimation of what was the actual genetic effect, and then we compared those less than twofold risks to what the first report had claimed, almost always the first positive report had overestimated the actual genetic effect. Okay, and we wanted to know if it's consistent with a phenomenon called the winner's curse. So winner's curse is best described for auction theory, and it goes like this. Imagine that there are a bunch of people who are bidding on an item, okay, and they all have an unbiased estimate of the value of that item, okay, but it's not that precise, so people are just as likely to overestimate its value as underestimate it. And they all place bids, and those unbiased bids will therefore, and let's say they bid what they think what the item is actually worth, those unbiased bids will fluctuate around the true value, and then one of those will have fluctuated up the most, and that will be the winning bid. Okay, so the winning bid, conditional on it being the winning bid, will almost always have overestimated the value. And this, the best description of this is a Samuelson article called "I Won the Auction But Don't Want the Prize." So you know, beware on eBay. But so in association studies, basically the winning bid is equivalent to the first person who gets an exciting enough result that they can publish it quickly and in a prominent journal and that sort of thing. And conditional on them having found something interesting, it's likely that they overestimated the true value. And the true value might either be a weaker effect, or actually no effect at all. And that only time can tell. And so we found that it was consistent, that the degree by which they overestimated was generally consistent with the winner's curse phenomenon. So this is kind of the take-home messages from reading the association study literature. So if you pick up a paper and it says that something is associated with disease, there is a possibility that it will be true, okay? But it's, I would say, well under 50%. Okay, it's not 0% either, but it's well under 50%. The genetic effects for associations are likely to be quite modest. So if somebody's claiming a five-fold effect and their confidence intervals go from 1.1 to 40, it's probably closer to 1.1, if not 1. And then because of these modest effects, you need large study size to detect these reliably and also to narrow those confidence intervals down. I'll just give you an example, our favorite example, for an association of a missense polymorphism, or we think that's the causal polymorphism, and type 2 diabetes is in a gene called PPAR-gamma, which is important for fat cell differentiation and is a nuclear hormone receptor, probably binds fatty acids. So the first study that was published is right here. So each line is a study. The point is the point estimate for the effect on diabetes, and actually in this case anything to the left of this line is an association with diabetes, and the line around the point represents the confidence interval around that estimate. Okay, so for example, this study up here, even though it shows that it trends towards association, was considered negative because this line crosses the 95% confidence interval crosses 1. So this is the first study, which you can see the winner's curse in action here. Overestimates is the strongest estimate of risk, and it was followed by, I believe, these three and a bunch of other studies, all of which were considered to be negative because their 95% confidence intervals crossed 1. We then did a pretty big study where we showed an association. We actually pointed out that all of the literature to date was consistent with an association somewhere in this range, much weaker than originally described, but modest enough that these studies didn't have power to pick it up. And in fact, as you get larger and larger samples, what you can see is that the confidence intervals, is that the things tend to really focus in, and you put all the data together, you get a pretty narrow confidence interval, and now the p-value for association is like 10 to the minus 9, so it's real. But it took 20,000 alleles from people with diabetes and controls to get there.
Are all these studies in the same protocol system actually? Can you really put them all together and do that overall?
So for diabetes, the definition of diabetes is pretty clear. There's a WHO consensus, and they're more or less the same definition. I would say close enough. The allele itself is clearly the same variant and assuming that the quality of genotyping was good, probably they were looking at the same thing there. Obviously, the populations are different. So I talked about population differences. So it turns out also one of the best examples of heterogeneity between populations is for this polymorphism, not so much in diabetes, although it hasn't really been looked at well, but actually obesity. So this has been looked at a lot for obesity and wildly divergent results. It turns out that how much trans fatty acids you eat, or saturated to unsaturated fatty acid, affects whether this polymorphism has an effect on obesity. I can't remember right now which way it goes. Basically, on one diet, which is much more common in Western countries, there's, I think, no effect. And on another diet, which is much more common in Asian countries, there is an effect on obesity. So you can imagine that they're, and actually if you look, it turns out that these three are all in Asian populations. So it could be that there is some heterogeneity going on there, although it's statistically marginally significant whether any of these studies are different than any of the others. So these are mostly consistent with if you took, darts and threw them all at the same odds ratio, you might end up with points that look more or less like that. But it could well be that there are differences. For things like, for less well, so for Alzheimer's disease, there's a little more debate sometimes of whether it's pathology confirmed or not and that sort of thing. So, all right, so what to believe is the kind of the question. So should you believe it? I would say initial skepticism is warranted. Replication, especially with low p-values, and maybe we can discuss what that means, is encouraging. Large sample sizes are crucial. So if you're going to take anything home, there you go. Okay, so I want to quickly, this is a sort of quantitatively oriented class, talk about applying Bayes' theorem to interpreting association studies. So Bayes' theorem is one of the fundamental theorems of probability. And in this case, what I've done is I've substituted in the words causal and associative probability of observing association, and causal is the probability that the variant that you're looking at actually is causal. So if you go through just plugging it into Bayes' theorem, this is what you get. And what you're interested in is basically, given that I've seen an association, what's the likelihood that it's true, right? That's what you want to know when you pick up the paper. So this has to do with three terms. One is the probability that something's associated, given that it was causal. So that's the power of the study, right? So would you see an association if it were causal? Would I have seen this association data if it were not causal? Well, that's the p-value, the probability of observing the data by chance. And then the probability that's causal to begin with, which is your prior probabilities. This is the key to Bayes' theorem, which is that you have to specify the priors, which is, of course, always the hardest part. It's very easy to write down Bayes' theorem, but then specifying your prior distribution can sometimes be quite tricky. All right, so I'm going to take you through what I believe prior distributions look like within a couple of orders of magnitude. So what are the prior probabilities? So I'm going to say there are about 600,000 independent common variants, and that has to do with the degree of redundancy that's been determined by the HapMap and stuff like that. There are 10 million in total. Some of them aren't that common, so I'm going to kind of shove those under the rug for a little bit. And of the rest, there's enough correlation that I'm going to say there's about 600,000 variants that you can type. The other assumption is that at least a few of those are going to be causal, so I'm assuming the common variants play some role in disease. Okay, so I'm going to say somewhere between 6 and 60. It may be more. But I would say causal to a degree where you have any power to detect them at all, because obviously you have no power to detect them, they may as well not exist from the point of view of this study. Okay, because if you plug in zero for your power, then everything starts canceling out. Okay, so that's your prior probability is 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 100,000, more or less. How about candidate genes? Let's say, I'm not studying, you could say this paper is not studying some stinking random variant. This is like the greatest candidate gene in the whole world. Well, so we've gone through the exercise of writing down all the candidate genes that we think are great candidate genes for diseases. And you usually come up with somewhere between, say, 100 and 500 genes. So let's say 300 that you come up with. And I would argue that you could tell as equally beautiful a story about almost all 300 of those genes once you knew post hoc that there was an association. Okay, so you can say, oh, of course, that's why protein kinase C theta is the key to diabetes, and you write your story. So I'm going to say that there are 300 candidate genes, all of them about equally likely to be associated. again, using some things about, there are about three or four blocks of linguistic equilibrium per gene, about three or four haplotypes per gene. I'm going to say there are about 12 independent variants per gene. So there's about 3,600 candidate variants on your list of 300 genes that you've just made. Let's assume, and this is, I think, somewhat generous, but, you know, let's assume that all that biology that went into making those, that list is worthwhile, and that half of all the causal variants are in the candidate genes. Well, then if you do all the multiplication, the prior probability is about 10 times higher for a candidate gene than it is for a random gene, 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000. And then what are the prior probabilities you suggested looking under a linkage peak? Let's go do all the genes under a linkage peak. Well, what are the prior probabilities there? Let's say, actually not 200 genes, let's say there are only 100 genes under a linkage peak. Again, the same 12 variants per gene. But this time, there's only one, the assumption is there's only one gene or one variant that's under that linkage peak that's actually contributing. So again, the probability works out to be about the same as a candidate gene, 1 in 1,000. So it's, I would say, you should probably at this point be agnostic as to whether you're focusing all your effort under a linkage peak or on a list of candidate genes that you've come up with through biology. So let's assume that you now do your study and you achieve some magical p-value of 0.05. What's the likelihood that there was an association that was correct? Okay, so the greatest candidate gene in the world, so this is actually, you know, I'm going to give you 10 times more likelihood that this was correct than your typical candidate gene, prior probability of 0.01. p-value 0.05, posterior probability, this is assuming you also perfect power to detect your association, which means you did this in a big study. If you do it in a small study, this number goes down because the power, this thing scales with power. So the posterior probability, the chance that you're right, about 15%. Okay, so that's a little bit disheartening maybe. How about a typical candidate gene? This is sort of the typical association study that's done. There's about a 1% chance that a p-value 0.05 represents a true association. Okay. Candidate under linkage peak, so calpain 10, 1% chance, okay, in a with a p-value 0.05. Now, their p-value is a little lower, but still, that's sort of not much lower. Random gene in the genome, basically guaranteed to be wrong with a p-value 0.05. So what kind of p-values do you need to actually have pretty good posterior probabilities? Again, this is assuming good power. So basically, what you need is p-values that are somewhere in the range of 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 6. And this could be a single study or all studies put together. Okay, so that's, so basically most reported associations are probably incorrect, but not all of them. Some will turn out to be correct. And I would say that if you have low p-values replicated or there's a really, 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 really good reason for plausibility, then that makes it much more likely to be right. And then just this last point, genes under linkage peaks are about the same as any other kind of candidate. Obviously, if you have a candidate that's in a good pathway and it's under a linkage peak, you know, probably raises its prior probability. Oh, sorry.
Combinatorial thing, theoretically, you're not just looking at whether the state is one SNP is present, but two potentially independent SNPs being present contributing.
Yeah, so I haven't talked at all, I only alluded briefly to gene-environment interaction, right, with the PPAR gamma and the diet thing, and I haven't talked at all about gene-gene interaction. So there's a hot debate going on in the field, I would say, about whether one should look for gene-gene interaction without any evidence that either gene is involved, which basically involves doing all the pairwise, at least, if not three-way or four-way or n-way combinations. And the challenge for that becomes apparent when you say that there are actually like 600,000 independent variants across the genome. So even if you're just doing pairwise, that's 6 times 10 to the fifth. So it ends up being 3.6 times 10 to the 11th variants, pairwise combinations that you have to look for. And so you know that you're actually going to get a p-value of 10 to the minus 11th for interaction at some point, just because that's how many pairs you've tested. In fact, you can get 3.6 of them. It becomes a issue of power again, in that to correct for all the different hypotheses that you'd be testing, you need an enormous sample size, or you need to hope that the interaction effect is just so enormous that you actually get a p-value that survives that correction for multiple hypothesis testing, which might be the case. But then the question is, if that interaction is so enormous, you have to draw very strange models that you wouldn't also pick up at least one of the two as being causal. Now, what should be done, but isn't, is that once you have something that you really believe, so for example, we work in the diabetes field, and we really believe people are gamma pro-12 alpha, but yet we do not yet, and we should, test for pairwise interactions for every single thing we genotype and pro-12 alpha, because you can draw plenty of reasonable models where you would only detect one of the two things that are interacting, and the other one would be completely masked, or largely masked. So we don't do that, and we should. But I would say that if you're picking up a paper which says, we didn't see anything with either one of these variants, but then we did the pairwise test, and we see an interaction, think about your prior probability that pairwise test was actually associated. Okay, the number of pairs in the genome versus the number that are actually going to be causal, your prior probabilities are probably several orders of magnitude lower. So unless there's, again, some really great reason to know that these genetic variants interact. So that's my incredibly biased answer to that, or not biased, but opinionated answer to that question. I won't go through why you get the same sort of winner's curse and things like that in linkage, but just to take you through rare variant association studies, again, just in case you pick up literature on this. So this is the typical rare variant association study as it is practiced in 2004. Genes are resequenced in affected individuals to try to find, say, missense variants, and then those missense variants are then taken and typed in unaffected individuals. So it's sequencing here, genotyping here. Okay, and what's often observed is that they're not there. So I'll take you through a possible resequencing association study. Let's resequence your favorite gene, gene X, 200 diabetic individuals, and lo and behold, you actually find 10 rare missense variants, each seen in one person with diabetes. You then type 200 healthy individuals. Those variants are not seen at all. So you conclude, thank you. Okay. That rare missense variants in gene X cause diabetes. Okay, so now I'm going to take you through an equally possible resequencing study. Resequence gene X in 200 Red Sox fans. You will identify if this is a gene that happens to tolerate rare missense variation. You will identify 10 rare missense variants. You might identify some common variants, but you might not. Many genes don't have any common missense variants. If you then take those 10 missense variants and type them in 200 other people, say Yankees fans, you will not see those variants. Okay, so this is very plausible. And you will conclude that rare variants in gene X make you root for the Red Sox, which, of course, is not the correct answer. And the reason for this has to do with the fact that in identifying these rare variants, you have to go to very great depth in doing the resequencing. So you get common variants if you sequence two chromosomes. That's what I showed you at the very beginning of the talk, right? So if you just compare two chromosomes and then look, are those variants common in the rest of the population? The answer is almost always yes. The average allele frequency is about 1 in 5. So average is 20% for the minor allele and 80% for the other allele. But if you then sequence a large group of people, you obviously find all these common variants. You find those in like the first four chromosomes you do. You basically run through all the common variants. But you actually keep finding variants as you go every once in a while, and this has to do with population genetics and what the allele frequency distributions are and stuff like that. But most of the variants you find, if you do deep resequencing, end up being these rare variants. They don't account for most of the heterozygosity because they're so rare. And in fact, their average frequency is something like 1 in 10,000. So if you type them in 200 people, you're never going to see any of them again. So what needs to get done is basically you need to resequence the controls as well. There are other ways of doing it. For example, if you have families, you can see that the rare variants actually segregate with disease. That's sort of equivalent to resequencing controls. So that's one way around it. but that's basically what you need to do. And furthermore, you know, what I said there in that previous study was you identified, you know, 10 missense variants. What if you had identified 11, but one of them was common, okay? And you said, well, that's a common one, and it's present in cases and controls, so that's probably not functional. You know, that's probably, and I'll just concentrate on the ones that are only present in cases. Well, that's obviously rigging the results beforehand, right? So you could, if you limit yourself to just those variants that are present in cases and say those are the only ones that matter, obviously they're only going to be present in cases. So you have to have some way of grouping these rare variants for analysis before you know the results of the association study of, you know, which ones are in cases and which ones are in controls. So something like either I'll only look at frameshifts or nonsense mutations, or I'll only look at things that have this particular in vitro functional property or something like that. Okay, so just in the last couple of minutes, or how, actually, how, I'm actually way ahead. Oh, no, not way ahead. Good, 12:30. Good. I was, for a minute, I thought I had like 37 minutes left. I was like, I've been talking longer than that. Okay, so what could we learn? And I think this is also important to think about, and kind of what are the goals and what are the likely outcomes? There's a lot of hype around the whole field of genomics and SNPs and common disease, and just to try to take a look at what is and is not likely. So I don't know if anybody's seen the movie Gattaca. So Gattaca, I think people actually have Gattaca in the back of their mind when they are thinking about this, which is that we should be able to tell by, you know, genotyping, if we could sequence somebody's genome, we will be able to predict, you know, if you look at the opening scene in that movie, it's like, you know, probability of coronary artery disease, like 98%, you know, probability of, you know, stroke, 100%, you know, this sort of thing. So we already know that genetic variation actually, even if we had perfect information, only explains like 30 to 50% of common disease. But what's even the likelihood that we'll get that good a prediction? I think it's probably not that great, because it's probably a lot of alleles that are going to interact in complex ways that we may not be able to figure out for a very long time. But nonetheless, there is some thought that we may be able to identify people who are at high risk, or particularly people who might be at low risk. If that were the case, and I've shown here a probably very optimistic scenario, which is that you could enrich this much for the high-risk people, you might say that these people would get a more aggressive intervention, preventive measure, and these people might get the standard of care, or might even be able to get slightly less aggressive interventions, depending on how the risk-benefit played out. This obviously requires that there be effective preventive measures and things like that, but you could imagine, you know, for things like diabetes, you could say, you know, you really are at high risk for getting diabetes, you really need to, you know, exercise and lose weight, and maybe that would, you know, there would be some, you know, you could hook that person up with a nutritionist and all the, you know, personal trainer and all that sort of stuff, and it might not be something that we as a society could afford for everybody, but maybe at least for the people who are the highest risk, we could afford it, if we could get there. But I don't think that this is necessarily really where the true promise lies. There's another possibility, and this is sort of called pharmacogenomics, which is basically reclassification of individuals to guide therapy. So you have this mix of people who have some disease, like type 2 diabetes, but it turns out it's actually type 2A, 2B, 2C, and 2D. And maybe we could classify them by DNA sequence or, you know, expression profile or some genomic method. And we could say, well, these people will do best with treatment A, these people with B, these with C, and these with D. And again, that may or may not come to pass, and certainly people are looking at it, and I think it's going to partially come to pass. I'll just give you one real-life example that actually is not in the clinic yet, but I'm not sure why not. There's a gene called CYP2C9, which actually metabolizes warfarin, which is used commonly to treat conditions involved with thrombosis or blood clotting. It's an anti-clotting agent, actually vitamin K. The white on yellow is not a good color scheme, but basically most of the population has zero low activity alleles, 20% of the population has one low activity allele, and 5% of the population have two low activity alleles. And if you look at the average dosage that people end up on by their genotype, so this dosage is not based on their genotype, it's like there's trial and error by the physician, and they find, you know, oh, you know, you're all of a sudden, you know, you're, you know, you have a nosebleed that won't stop, maybe your warfarin dose is too high, or your PT value is too high, we have to cut the dose. You see that there's a very nice allele versus dose correlation here, so that, you know, if you have two low activity alleles and you get put on the typical 5 milligram dose, you're going to have bleeding problems. Okay, in fact, you're going to be at 6 times the risk of serious complications. So personally, if I were going on warfarin, I would probably want to know what my CYP2C9 genotype was, but it's not yet standard practice. One of the only cases that I know that is actually if you have cancer and you're getting 6-mercaptopurine or related drugs, there's a gene called TPMT, which again metabolizes that into a toxic intermediate, and that has now become pretty much the standard of care, because again the risk of death is higher if you have the wrong genotype, so death gets people's attention quite vigorously.
That's average dose, right?
So there's a range.
There's a histogram.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so I have to say I should have put error bars on here. I was looking at that and just noticing I did not have them. Right, but... So if this were... If you could say, well, physicians can do this without knowing ahead of time, then this should not happen, right? So this is the argument is, oh, well, you know, physicians are kind of going to be good at this anyway. They're not. They suck at it, okay? So... But I think the other thing that is potentially useful, so if you look at least the two most well-established risk alleles for type 2 diabetes. Turns out they're both in drug targets. Now, this is admittedly a little bit circular because the reason they were looked at was because it was known ahead of time that they were drug targets, so they made sense as being good candidate genes. But it is interesting that, you know, two of the major drugs that are used to treat type 2 diabetes, there's variants in their targets that affect the genetic susceptibility to diabetes. And of course, the promise here is that if you could find all of the other genetic pathways, even if they only had a 1.1-fold effect on disease, so PPAR gamma is only about a 25% risk effect on risk of disease, but you could easily imagine that you come up with a pharmacologic event intervention that does a lot more than the genetic polymorphism does. So there's, you know, only so much tolerance for how much genetic variation evolution will let happen, but it might be that you could, you know, giving thiazolidinediones might be like, you know, having, you know, 10 times as much of an effect as having an alanine allele does. So the idea is that hopefully by identifying the genes that are responsible, and this is true for severe forms of the disease as well, you might identify drug targets. And finally, of course, you know, this helps just understand human biology, and that's always a worthy goal. So should talk about potential difficulties from all these from all these advances. There are obviously concerns about privacy with genetic data, and don't really have time to go into it, but obviously there's the big fear has to do with insurance discrimination and employers knowing about genetic diseases, and there's bills that keep making it almost all the way through Congress and not quite to deal with this. It's a lobbyer congressman. There's sort of the Gattaca mindset about, you know, improper interpretation of predictive information, how predictive genetic information is. There are companies that will try to sell you that you should be on diet A or diet B based on SNP genotypes that are in those irreproducible associations. There can be, you know, psychological impacts of if you say, you know, you have the high risk allele for diabetes, that might, without an understanding that this is a correlative rather than a perfectly predictive measure, that could have significant harm, as well as impact on reproductive choices, again, depending on how predictive people think things are. There are huge interactions with concepts of race and ethnicity. We alluded to this a little bit with different allele frequencies in different populations. Most alleles are present around the world, and you can't use generally any one variant to tell different ethnic groups apart, but there are definitely differences in allele frequencies between populations, and that has significant interaction, implications. And then finally, you know, I certainly don't study the genetics of performance, but you could imagine that if people started getting into that, they could be quite dicey. And even if the science were perfect from a technical standpoint, it might create a lot of trouble. So David Altshuler is collaborator with me on the diabetes work, and also very involved in the HapMap with the work that was done by Stacey Gabriel, Mark Daly, Steve Schaffner on haplotype blocks. The diabetes group also is Noelle, Leif, Cecilia, Vomsi did some expression stuff, and Kirk and Lee and Eric were on the meta-analysis of association study, and there are a lot of genome project type things that are obviously giving us all the tools to do this. So thanks.